You're listening to Garden Futurist. I'm Sarah Beck, and here to help me introduce today's episode is Haven Kears, Associate Professor of Landscape Architecture at University of California, Davis. Hi, Haven.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I have to say, Noel Kingsbury is really in such an interesting, evolved place in a lot of conversations that I think we have all the time, and it's fun to let him take us there. This goes so much further than the, I don't want some messy habitat garden. We've all seen a messy habitat garden. It's hard to almost convey without having a knowledge of how these design movements have occurred over time in different places. It feels like he's giving us a window into something that's further along than I think a lot of the rest of the conversations are.
He speaks with confidence, which makes it feel like we can get there. When he was talking about gardens as that interface of nature and culture. Just the acceptance of that and the statement that that is what it's all about then makes everything else work. All of the craziness of, you know, messiness and how does that work with ecology? It's just like, okay, this is the interface. Now, if you want to get fancy, reconciliation ecology approach or novel ecosystem, whatever term, but he's putting it in this nature and culture. And so it's about people. It's about people understanding gardens and seeing them, but doing so in an ecological way. And he just made it sound so attainable, right? And then giving these ways of how can you do that?
Let's listen to my conversation with internationally acclaimed horticulture writer, garden and planting designer, Noel Kingsbury. The level of analytics that you have been bringing to just the design process components, it's really interesting to me. You know, we're kind of in an interesting 2.0 era, or maybe it's even more than 2.0. I don't know. Like if coffee can be third wave, fourth wave, you know, I just think it's really interesting how far you've gone with the analysis of the components. I want you to feel free to really elaborate on that. You're talking about very naturalistic or ecological processes, and yet you're really using this sort of really almost scientific human framework. I don't know if that resonates with you.
It speaks of confidence, which is really nice. Yes. Yeah, you kind of witter on about these things. It's nice to know every now and again people think you're saying the right thing, not just talking into the void. Yes.
We are obviously facing some serious climate challenges, and especially here on the West Coast and many, many parts of the world, urbanization is big. We're all going to be living in cities in future years. I'm just curious if you can talk a little bit about the future and just our opportunities to think about garden design as part of this integration of humans and habitat.
One of the key things about the garden is that it is the interface of nature and culture, and that for a great many people, this is their predominant engagement with something that could be conceivably be called nature. And on all scales, at a time when nature, biodiversity is facing enormous challenges because of urbanization and climate change, that the garden, in the broadest sense, should be a place where we can, as well as celebrate the beauty of plants and the functionality of that space, it should also serve nature. So my point really was that we should be planning garden spaces as also conservation spaces, that obviously we have to please people, and that is what a garden, public or private, is about. But at the same time, it should support biodiversity. But actually, perhaps that should be targeted. Perhaps we should be thinking very much about particular threatened species, flora or fauna, that could be served by the habitat that create and we label as gardens.
We'll get into that a little deeper, I think, regarding the specific habitat plants. I'd like to actually do a little bit of defining of terms here. I know you mentioned naturalistic planting as a term, as opposed to ecological planting. Can you just share the difference, if there is a really clear difference between those two terms?
So many terms we use around describing planting are very, very relative, and they're very relative to the culture in question at the time in question. I shall never forget the late Jim Van Sweden showing him around a planting I was doing in probably 1996. And he said, oh, the American public were nowhere near ready for this. And, you know, X number of years later, this is what Phyto Studio, Claudia West and Thomas Ray, and this is what they're doing. So I think that acceptance can change quite quickly. The more formal and the more constrained a garden culture is in its use of plants, the more people use words like informal or naturalistic to describe something that, you know, is not in a straight line or isn't clipped within an inch of its life. In terms of these two particular terms, naturalistic and ecological, I use them both, a lot of us use them both. I'm really very keen that we do try to keep these quite clearly defined because they operate as two ends of a spectrum. I love this thing of the gradient. You know, you have black and white and infinite shades of grey in between. And it's a very, very good way of understanding a lot in nature, but also a lot in culture as well, because in culture, again, it's like nature. There's a whole series of gradations. You know, by naturalistic, it'd be useful if we think about this as plantings that, for most people, look pretty natural, but in fact have a very strong human priority aesthetic. Pete Aldolf planting, I think, would be a very good case in point. I mean, in fact, anyone who was really had any appreciation of wild vegetation could look at a Pete Aldolf garden and say, you know, this does not look like the wild. But in actual fact, as far as the majority of certainly Western urban viewers, it is pretty wild. And the key thing is it's kind of wilder than perhaps what went on before. But it is absolutely not ecological. And by ecological, I mean a planting that I think crucially has something like the density of biomass of natural vegetation. Because so much planting, including quite a lot of naturalistic planting, when you consider the number of plants per square meter, the biomass per square meter, it is still pretty low compared to what you find in a natural environment. And I get paroxysms of delight when I come across a clearly designed planting, but which has been allowed to develop to the point where there is no bare soil and where you've got this really dense, multi-layered occupation of volume by as many different plant species as possible. And I have seen examples in, obviously, the temperate zone. I've seen it in Mediterranean gardens and I've seen it in tropical gardens. It is possible, but it requires a particular confidence in using plants, but also an understanding of how plants fit together in space. In terms of really helping biodiversity, we've got to have that vegetation biomass there for it to have any real ecological function.
This is a really interesting element of this conversation, this idea of density. And I want to just expand on this question around looking at wild landscapes. It's very natural for those of us who are in the world of horticulture to also love delving into wild places. And we have to temper this. And maybe definitions are important here too, because there really are very few truly wild landscapes in the world left. Unfortunately, when we go into naturally managed landscapes, you know, like national parks and spaces that are preserved that are not truly gardened, when we go into those spaces, I think as horticulture people, we get so inspired, and especially at this time of year, we think, how, as a gardener, how would that translate back to an actual garden setting? Do you feel like the core of that is really this planting density, or are there other things that are tangible ideas that might translate from, you know, our inspiration of a wild landscape into a garden setting?
The kind of wild or supposedly wild landscapes that people get inspired by are often relatively short-lived. They're often early succession landscapes, or they are created by a very specific set of conditions, like European meadows, for example. They don't last for very long, and they're in fact anthropogenic in the first place. So I think that we really should be inspired by things at a deeper level. You know, one key element is often repetition. Repetition of particular forms or colors in space is what you typically find in many natural environments. I think that the intensity of repetition, which is something we appreciate, I think, very, very intuitively, is something that's very important. It's very personal. I mean, a lot of people appreciate landscapes that are often in some way kind of tidy or inevitably fit to a human aesthetic. I remember going to New Zealand, the wet, wild West Coast, and everywhere just looked like a really well-designed office car park. It was a sort of graphic vegetation. We need stuff that we can read. People who vary enormously in their levels of vegetation literacy, and that's often very much related to one's culture. There's part of the sort of balancing act between satisfying the human aesthetic, but also satisfying that biodiversity demand. diversity and complexity in themselves can be very attractive. You know, if the diversity and complexity is readable, then the more depth there is to appreciate something, the more pleasure it should give.
There's this moment in time, as you're just saying, and then you go back to your garden and it's like you want to maintain some kind of freakishly long period of something that really in nature only exists for a moment. You've talked a lot about the management of the ecological garden and how this is a little bit more of a journey, not a destination, in a very real sense. You know, you've talked about the design process of editing. And can you just talk a little bit about how you can maintain something that is densely planted? And what is the perspective shift that needs to occur there in order to really keep it thriving?
Well, when a planting matures to a certain level of density, it, to some extent, it does look after itself. I mean, when you've got every ecological niche filled, there's often less work to do, less work fighting off undesirable weeds or invasives or whatever. You're then sort of editing, managing, snipping away, you know, occasionally doing something more drastic to restart a process. It's intervening in a natural process, doing it in ways that are often very intuitive, often very, very site and environment and habitat specific. Any garden is a garden in transition. It's just that in the sort of conventional gardens, it's very much about bringing it always back to the same point. Whereas in an ecological garden, we are accepting that there will be changes that will perhaps be inevitable. We can't always have the same effect every year, and it would be unrealistic to do so. And we, you know, we're working really with change continually moving forward.
This really makes me think of my like way back ecology learning, you know, that natural progression between, say, a meadow moving to, say, a forest. In a home garden, maybe you stop it before it actually becomes a forest.
And this whole way of working with succession, I mean, it has been formalized in a way. The Dutch hame parks, which from the 1930s onwards, there's a cycle. I don't know quite how long it is. It's probably something like about 20 years or so. They will take everything back to the bare peat, you know, re-sow the ruderal species of a peat bog flora. That's quite pretty for a few years. And then the heathers and the vaccinium blueberry relatives and things move in, and it gradually changes, and you end up back with a forest and scrub again in 20 years or whatever. They very, very consciously use that succession cycle. I think an awful lot does come back to succession. I always start my workshops with succession, of getting people to think through how succession works in their particular locality.
So what are some of the factors to consider in terms of how we can manage landscapes this way? Can we imagine the horticulture industry evolving in a way that our greater knowledge and our landscape skills can evolve to manage these types of landscapes? Is this even possible? And how would we go about that?
There needs to be a lot of rethinking about careers and training. But the fact is that if you have people who are doing the kind of really tedious mowing and cutting to keep it all the same, that is, you know, more labor, whereas an ecological landscape can be maintained with less labor, but it needs a higher standard of supervision. You're basically paying for skill rather than grunt effort. You know, I just think it would be wonderful if we could develop a way of bringing together those skills of horticulture and ecology. So we're training people who can, you know, manage landscapes or supervise the management of landscapes in a way that's really very subtle and very responsive to what they are reading going on in that situation at the time. So the job would be infinitely more satisfying. Well, I'm not the only person who's kind of making noises about this. I think we inevitably will move towards a new kind of training. I mean, the new RHS Level 2, World Horticultural Society Level 2 certificate is kind of a step in that direction. I'm glad to say I teach on that. That is, it's really nice to see that institutional change beginning to move in that direction.
If you're accustomed to seeing someone show up and run a bunch of equipment and blow things and cut things, as you're saying, I almost feel like there's this mental shift that needs to happen. I think we have to translate something so it's not like, oh, you need something to do for X number of hours because, you know, you were blowing or mowing something for 5 hours. We need to make 5 hours worth of money out of this. I mean, in a way, that's sort of the bigger leap, right?
Yes, yes.
Do you have advice for designers who want to move into this? I mean, obviously, designers are interlinked with this maintenance story, but I think there's also a part that backs even further up. You know, if you're designing for someone else, how do you bring them into this conversation? This kind of comes back also to our Design Futurist Award and really the motivation behind it, which is let's encourage those designers who want to work with the ecology.
One answer is head out into the hills and look at natural vegetation and really, really look at it and try to read it, try to analyze it. But also, I think crucially, garden at home. And I think there's a real difference between designers who know their plants only at second hand through to those who actively garden. I mean, I think this is, you know, some of the best people in planting design are certainly those who have, you know, really very actively gardened, even perhaps involved in the nursery trade in plant production, where you really do get to understand about how plants grow over time. You know, it's like a chef in a Michelin restaurant who only eats burgers, you know, unless you're actually engaging with what you are producing. Yeah, I just don't see how you can really appreciate how those ingredients are going to work out. I just realized it's one of those things you do just need to build up a massive amount of experience over time, which is very much about getting out and seeing designed landscapes, planting designs, successful, unsuccessful, just really being observant, photographing, making notes, whatever means people have that works for them in terms of recording and analyzing.
Getting out and looking and just really learning observation. That's a really powerful piece of this, I think.
Yeah, it is. Yes.
And it's sciencey too, which is fun.
And in the West, you know, where you're on the West Coast of the United States, you do have the most incredible range of very different habitats within a very short space. I mean, you are really blessed like that in a way that, you know, most of us simply are not.
That is very true. And the range of plant communities that we can just pop into and experience, because there's so many microclimates, it is very, very cool. I want to get into a nice controversial topic, because on the Pacific Coast, when you get really nerdy on this, there's some disagreement about whether to favor only native species in biodiverse garden plantings, or whether to embrace this idea of the novel ecosystem. At Pacific Horticulture, we've covered a lot of these conversations and recently even delved into what are we even talking about when we're talking about a native plant? Because there's not an agreed upon definition when we're talking about origins and floristic province and all of that. Can you just talk about the argument for that, this new nature idea? We're not dealing with a wild space.
Yeah. I think increasingly now people do accept that the, inverted commas, natural vegetation of an area is the outcome of a set of stochastic events. That if you were to rewind the tape of history and how many ice ages we had over the last 2 million years, I think six, you would end up with a somewhat different flora. There's nothing holistic about a natural flora. It's just what's kind of ended up there in that space after X amount of geological time. Novel ecosystems, sometimes we are presented with them by not necessarily even invasive species, but non-native species that we simply can't get rid of. We have to work with. That's the sort of bottom line. And obviously with climate change, then ecosystems are going to change anyway. And therefore, we cannot afford to cling to too restrictive an idea of native plant. A more useful concept, I think, is probably one that relates to taking native in a very broad sense, because there is increasing evidence that if you think about, you know, some of the worst invasives are very often from, and they're not from the North American continent, they're from Australia or South Africa or Eurasia, that over the last few millions of years, there's been so much to-ing and fro-ing of vegetation within each continental block that there are certain adaptations that mean that you would be very unlikely to have any real surprises, and that it's very, very subtle biochemical markers, for instance, that make particular plants from another continent, you know, very, very problematic. I'm just flagging up the hedge garlic inhibiting oak seedling growth through the suppression of the symbiotic fungi. That's the kind of level at which now invasive theory is moving towards.
You're listening to Garden Futurist. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you to First Editions for sponsoring this episode. First Editions Shrubs and Trees takes the hard work out of yard work. With a passion for plants that are as hardworking as you are, First Editions has curated a collection that's as fun as it is functional. It's beauty and brawn. From trusted regional favorites like vanilla, strawberry, panicle, hydrangea, to fantastic native selections like fiber optics, buttonbush. Each plant has been handpicked for top-notch performance. But that's not all. First Editions goes the extra mile by introducing plants with better flowering, greater disease resistance, lower maintenance needs, and more. These are plants that truly deliver year after year. They're plants with purpose. Plus, you'll spot them easily in our distinctive bright purple pots. Follow First Editions on social media and head to firsteditionsplants.com to see the full collection, browse helpful resources, shop online, or find a local garden center near you. First Editions, the most fun you've ever had with shrubs and trees. The Design Futurist Award elevates the power of garden design to achieve climate resilience, steward biodiversity, and connect people with nature. The award celebrates garden design that is easily replicable, modest in scale, or designed for intimate neighborhood community use. Gardens must be located within the Pacific region, defined here as California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, Hawaii, Alaska, and Baja California. Visionary designers and regional plants people, this is your call. Submission is easy. Learn more at pacifichorticulture.org or pacifichorticulture.org/design-futurist. Deadline to submit is July 26th, 2024. I'm going to bring up another classic argument, and I think this is a classic bias that's really common, which is the habitat plantings, the ecological gardens are described as messy. I think this is where I find it really interesting that you go so deep on your analysis of design principles and some of these underlying structures, and when you talk about the form of plants. I'm just curious to hear you talk a little bit about how that structure gets imposed, or even how the aesthetic changes so that we can see structure within and actually see design in those settings that are ecological and biodiverse.
I think having signature species for each season is always helpful. Something that you're growing that definitely does look good for every season, that always just helps attract attention away from what others might perceive as mess. I mean, I just think the whole history of clipping stuff in the United States has so much kind of bad energy about it. Just going back again to Jim Van Sweden, you could not have a sensible conversation with that man about clipping because every example he knew was just so goddamn awful. Whereas I think one of the really nice things that comes through from 20th century Dutch design is this kind of rethinking of the clipped shape. That if you've got stuff that is geometrically clipped, that so obviously reads intention. And that if the stuff in between looks a bit of a mess, well, it's fairly obvious that that is kind of allowed for that particular season. I think very simple contemporary clipping can achieve wonders. For a lot of people, clipping reads art, and other stuff doesn't. I should never forget a Kurdish friend of mine who has, you know, absolutely zero interest in plants or vegetation. Brought him to where I was living at the time for, say, the weekend. It was a wild garden, and he didn't show any interest in it. But I had this magazine lying around from the Boxwood and Topiary Society, and, ooh, he loved that. I felt duly put in my place. That ability to use just occasional, really skillfully clipped elements can do so much. In Britain now, we have unfortunately fallen into the same trap of an awful lot of low-quality shrub-based environments, which were never intended to be clipped, are now being clipped, and almost 99% without any kind of artistry whatsoever. Whereas, in fact, with a little bit more training, you could be training those personnel to do stuff that is just actually kind of looks more intentional, but also has the ability to carry off wilder surroundings. I think that's rather nice because it does. Clipping and training was always a part of traditional horticulture. giving that a new life and a definitely sort of contemporary aesthetic, working alongside ecological planting. It's just a wonderful way to combine culture and nature.
Well, and I also remember from your book on the Dutch gardens that there was some kind of subtle hardscape elements that did a little bit of that framing as well. Do you feel like the hardscape is an important component?
Yeah. Particularly for ordering framework in the winter, yeah.
You mentioned this concept of boundaries between wild species and planted ones. And I think that it was your own garden that you were talking about doing some experiments with. And I'm curious if you could talk about this idea of, you know, allowing some wild species that are maybe on the periphery of your garden space and letting those be part of the landscape.
My last garden, which was on the England-Wales borders, high rainfall, fertile soils. My weed problem was huge, but it was overwhelmingly perennials. But, you know, there were certain elements that, particularly early spring things, Anthriscus sylvestris, Ranunculus repens, that kind of invited themselves in, but post-June tended to be either become dormant or be overshadowed by taller perennial stuff. So it was an introduction to being quite pragmatic. I mean, the Ranunculus repens is a particular kind of pet hate of anyone who gardens in the western half of the British Isles. But in fact, it can't grow that tall. And if you grow any perennial that's growing bigger than it by May is going to be suppressing it anyway. Now, here in Portugal, my weed flora is huge and overwhelmingly annual. And I've got this arreche, really sandy, gritty soil. So weeding here is so easy. And we have so many wonderful asteraceae, so many yellow daisies of various different kinds and various other things. So I'm sort of now getting to know this spontaneous flora, and a lot of it you can just let it flower, and it's wonderful having all this mist of yellow daisies amongst all your stuff. And then just before they start to seed, start pulling them all out, obviously targeting certain things first. But it does mean that that element can be part of the garden, but I now know how to manage it. On a heavier soil it would be less easy to manage, and I would need to be kind of stricter about it. But even so, you could develop other techniques that are sort of hoeing off or deadheading just before the dry period when it wouldn't be enough moisture after that to make the stuff seed anyway. It takes a bit of a time to kind of learn what your local weed flora is, how difficult it is, how aggressive or pernicious, but also potentially what it can offer. And if something is easily controllable, then, you know, we need this sort of new category almost of a spontaneous plant that needs managing rather than something that is inherently problematic.
I love that. You have also said that designers need to be more analytical about the plant forms and in thinking about the seasonal change and structures of the plants and how they can be intermingled or maybe even act as scaffolding for each other at different moments. And I'm seeing that as being connected to your whole idea about, you know, where you're creating that feeling of the hand of the gardener as opposed to just reading it as a more chaotic space. I think it's similar to what you were just talking about. Can you talk a little bit about this observation for structure?
I mean, it's something I think I was always vaguely aware of, because I remember, I think when the very early book I wrote was called Architectural Plants, but that was more about kind of dramatic, spiky stuff. And it's Pete Audolph who very much introduced me to this idea of categorizing plants by structure. That's been a very key part of why he has been so successful as a designer. But I mean, his way of using plants is actually, at the end of the day, really very formulaic. But it really introduced me to this idea, you know, with perennials, herbaceous perennials, they go through a number of phases through the year, and they are genetically determined to develop a particular shape, unless Tracy de Sabato Horse comes along and does a kind of mid-season prune, in which case, again, what they do is different, but again, it's kind of predictable. It's all about where the plant is actually putting energy into flower spikes or branching or whatever. With woody plants, of course, they're much more plastic, much more flexible. But again, they all have a tendency to develop particular architectures. Of course, in ecological planting design, we are growing stuff together so much more tightly. You know, we have to think about how things, in spatial terms, actually mesh together. I sort of thought this through in terms of herbaceous plants. But I'm going for this walk in a particularly rich, what we would call a maquis-type habitat. I suppose the equivalent for you would be chaparral, a Mediterranean climate dominated by subshrubs. And certainly sort of light bulb moment that, you know, we think of subshrubs as going towards a kind of hemisphere. In fact, realizing there's a whole typology that some of them do form, given the chance, a kind of nice round form. A lot of other ones grow them in a conventional term. They're so messy. But in fact, what they're doing, they're penetrating the others. They're sort of sending branches up through other plants. And others are coming under, others are going over. In fact, space is being occupied by a number of different architectures. And it occurred to me, right, what we need is a typology of these plants to help designers, you know, mesh things together, make the most effective use of space, pack in as much biodiversity as possible, but also create a planting that is complex, but at the same time would reduce maintenance and also enables you to use more plants. You're not rejecting things like Cistus albicans or Salvia cantilebra because they are messy, but if they're meshed in with nice hummock forms like certain other Cistus or Lavandula, then it all works. You know, I think the same really applies with herbaceous perennials, or there's a real difference between North American and European. In Europe, we have a lot of climbing herbaceous plants, which we hardly use in horticulture at all, vetches, mostly pea family stuff, that can be incorporated. We certainly have a lot of floppers, things that are grown in a conventional garden border just collapse. In fact, in nature, their long flowering stems are supported by surrounding plants, that they never grow in isolation. They grow in with others, and it's that those spatial relations of genetic traits towards shape that we need to do more characterization of. But I think anyone who works with plants develops a lot of this stuff intuitively anyway.
There's not necessarily a conscious formula of, yes, I've classified each of these as having this different structure and the flopper goes with the spike or however that gets assembled. You have talked a little bit also about the underground structures having a support of what you're talking about, right? There's an element there of what are the root systems and the rhizomes doing to help you with how that all performs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Years ago, I ran a small nursery, grew a lot of herbaceous plants. And I think the people who understand often the best about what goes on underground are people in the nursery business if they're digging plants up and dividing them. We are so inevitably and obviously divorced from what goes on underground, made worse by container growing. You buy plants from the garden center in a container, knock it out of the pot, and you don't really see what's going on underground, whereas if you were bare root, you do. About 7 or 8 years ago, I started digging up a lot of stuff, power washing soil off the roots, which in the winter with, you know, heavy soil is a pretty cold, horrible, messy exercise, and then photographing them, which is actually very difficult because you've got to sort of have a studio set up and you've got to get the depth of field right. It's looking through all my pictures, I realize that so often I've left kind of roots that are obscuring. You actually need to kind of prepare specimens really well. But it contributed enormously to my understanding of how plants, or how perennials operate over time, particularly with different rates and types of rhizoma to spread. It's that ability that I think to try to, you know, look at a relatively unfamiliar plant and say, well, I think in 5 years' time or 10 years' time, it might be like that. And I then discovered 4 or 5 years ago, I discovered a 1962 doctoral thesis from a Polish university, which just had this incredibly elegant theory that has been enormously useful in helping me understand many different aspects of perennials. And I recently met a brilliant young self-trained botanical artist who will do these amazing drawings from photographs or from live. This is definitely a zeitgeist thing. I spotted the other day an academic colleague in the Czech Republic who's just started a quite a kind of cartoony blog called What Goes On Underground. What goes on underground is increasingly going to be a bit of a zeitgeist because it is, in a way, certainly with herbaceous plants, this is actually the most important part of the plant because the top stuff just dies back every winter. And it's this stuff underground that really tells you what that plant is going to do over time.
Even just the project you were just talking about with the trying to spray the soil off the roots totally reminds me of the project that Jerry Glover did at the Land Institute years ago. And it ended up being a really fascinating show at the U.S. Botanic Garden. Dr. Glover did something really similar with prairie plants. There is kind of a mind-blowing moment for people to recognize, you know, the entire portion of a plant that's existing underground. You just mentioned perennials too. This idea of the herbaceous perennials being a really long-term garden design trend for people. And I think you were wanting to make a little bit of a case for some woody plants. And, you know, obviously a lot of conversation has happened, at least in the U.S. recently, in terms of ecology and the importance of these keystone species. And I know for where we are on the West Coast, like the oak tree is now considered just an absolute keystone piece of this. What's your thought on integrating trees, woody plants?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's somewhat unfortunate that the revival of interest in herbaceous perennials in the 1990s coincided with this development of interest in ecological planting and biodiversity in gardens. And I think if they, again, take record of history, that might have played out differently at another time. And unfortunately, also, because herbaceous plants deliver pretty quickly, within 3 years, you, after having spent out in your whole new border, it can be looking pretty established. The fact that a lot of the best private gardens have been funded by the financial kleptocracy, who are impatient people anyway, whose short-term investment decisions are screwing all of us. They want something that's almost like an instant garden. I mean, a Dutch colleague who described a lot of new perennial planting as being like Victorian bedding, instant trees and shrubs you have to wait for, and if you can afford to buy in a load of semi-mature stuff. All the evidence is that a woody plant layer is hugely important for biodiversity. I've been in correspondence with Doug Tallamy a bit lately, and he sent me a paper on keystone species, but it was all woody plants. Now, there's absolutely a very small number of species, all of them woody, support a huge amount of biodiversity. So actually integrating the woody and the perennial. And of course, for winter, you know, once all your perennials have been cut down and waiting for your bulbs to come up, it looks pretty bleak. And, you know, we do need that woody plant structure. So I'm very much keen that we start to think about using woody plants and not just sticking a few around the edge, but actually really integrating them into design. Just thinking about understory species, about how we treat the shrubs in terms of creating more space for herbaceous underneath. And I was delighted to see that really totally far out and could only be produced on the American West Coast book on shrubs.
Oh, I know the book you're talking about. I think we have somebody reviewing that.
Amazing book. Drawing our attention to the complexity, the amazing complexity of kind of scrub, chaparral, maquis type habitats. It's getting that integration between the two that is, I think, vitally important.
Is there anything you would like to share just in terms of your hopes for the future, since we're futurists here? Like, for anyone who's going into these fields or is in a design field or an ally of horticulture, can you give us some encouragement? Like that this is going to work and we're going to get somewhere.
Our knowledge of vegetation as a system increases all the time. And when you look back 100 years to William Robinson and just how completely they knew nothing about ecology, then, you know, we have learned a lot. You know, we're learning a lot more all the time. I think anything that gets out across to young people, I mean, anything that gets kids growing or people in communities growing is really, really important. And I think, you know, those of us who kind of understand about vegetation, you know, we need to be very, get out there and explain it.
Haven, as one of our founding committee members from just the inception of the Design Futurist Award, I'm really interested in your insight around what this tells designers, especially in the Pacific region, who are pursuing this type of work and they're really evolving their own practices and developing designs that can seek to achieve this idea of this balance. These are living plants. They're in their ecosystem. Can we take some of this advice from Noel Kingsbury, and can that help to guide some of the design movement that we are trying to encourage through Design Futurist, which is really making these design ideas accessible to more people, whether you're a designer, a plants person, or whether you're a gardener and you're wanting to engage in these same practices, right?
Yeah. And I think what was really great about what he was saying is, so yes, it is a process and it's about a long-term collaboration with sort of the designer and the person who's maintaining it, which with a home garden usually is the same person. But so there's that understanding that it is a long term and it takes time. And even like at the small thing, like talking about signature species for each season, I thought was brilliant. And especially in California, where our spring garden is the most spectacular. And I'm like, okay, when's it going to be April? When's it going to be April? So then my garden bursts in and it's like, okay, that's great, but you really have to start thinking about what are those other seasons and how to have something spectacular at each of those. Just because something is messy in nature doesn't mean it has to be messy in your garden. And so going to the cues to care. And so really taking some of these and using those to display, to bring in the ecological principles, but do it in a way that people can understand.
This is a really exciting moment to share the 2024 Design Futurist Award. The call for submissions is out. We want to see great ideas. We want to see accessible, intimate scale projects. We want to see things that are urban. We want to see things that are community. I think there's a really wide range of what can really solve the question that we're asking for designers to solve. And I think there are just so many innovative, wonderful designers out there who are doing this work. And I also feel like a lot of folks that work at a smaller scale don't get recognized.
Oh, there's no question about that. That's my favorite part of this award, is that it is the super cool, innovative, small designers that are doing these things, that are making changes. And it's a lot harder to make a spectacle on a small scale. And to be able to do that and to get that wow factor in a yard or a smaller project, if you're just working in the scale of a small front yard, you really have to be good at it. I think this is super exciting. I can't wait to see the new submissions. And I would just add a challenge of, is there a way to make your submission more dynamic in terms of seasonality? Because we are obviously asking for photos and drawings and all of that, but can you show your garden at different seasons, even how it's changed over time, right? Because that is what we're talking about, is that it's not just the moment in time.
Haven, thank you so much for issuing the call.
Thanks everyone for listening today. If you liked Garden Futurist, please share it on your favorite social media platform or follow us on Spotify. Find us at pacifichorticulture.org.